Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Indian Religions, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Shruti Dixit, the host of the channel, and today we will be talking to Professor Jonathan Edelman about his book, Hindu Theology and Biology, the Bhagavad Puran and Contemporary Theory, published by the Oxford University Press. John is an assistant professor of religion at the University of Florida. The book we are going to discuss was awarded the 2011 John Templeton Foundation Award for Theological Promise, and is known for developing a constructive and comparative theological dialogue between Hinduism and Western natural sciences. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm currently an assistant professor at the University of Florida, and I do teach courses on Indian religion, Asian religion, Asian philosophy, science and religion. I teach everything from undergraduate, first year undergraduate level courses to all the way up to PhD level students and everything in between. And I'm doing research now in the area of Hindu philosophy, theology, kind of a textual history, trying to reconstruct certain ideas from Sanskrit texts primarily and their commentarial traditions, especially from like the 15th and 16th century in North India. That's my has been, and I've got a book project that I'm working on. And I have a family, and I live here in Gainesville, Florida, and that about sums it up at this point, I would say.
It's great to know about you, John. Well, to begin with, I'm intrigued why you use the term worldviews for Bhagavad and Darwinianism.
Yeah, so there's a couple of issues with the word worldviews. It was a kind of term of its time, I think. It was a term that I had been taught when I was an undergraduate. I guess I around that time, I was an undergraduate in philosophy. I did a bachelor's of philosophy, and I engaged with religious studies at the University of California in Santa Barbara. And I'd studied... I never really studied with him. He was retired by the time I had gotten there, but Ninian Smart, who was very instrumental. I believe he was Scottish or Irish, I can't remember, but he's from the northern part of the UK, but he taught in the University of California at Santa Barbara for many years. And he had used this word, and it had been a term I had thought about some, and I more or less just appropriated or adopted it as a way of attempting to capture some of the philosophical, mythological, historical narrative, proto-scientific ideas that I saw in the Bhagavata Purana, which I was reading, and other Hindu and to a certain degree Buddhist texts that I was reading at the time. And I also found it as a kind of helpful term to create the kind of comparative discussion that I had worked on in that book, because it had been applied to science as well. So it became a kind of a bridge term, I guess I would say, this term worldviews, as theology, philosophy, myth. I'd see these are all kind of bridge terms in different ways. As I became interested in this science and religion dialogue, which I also encountered at the University of California in Santa Barbara as an undergraduate, as I began to engage with these topics of science and religion, it was a term that people used at the time, and I think it's probably not used as much right now, and it's not a term that I use too frequently anymore at this point. But I found it very helpful as kind of creating certain categories or dimensions, as Ninian Smart referred to, but categories I would refer to now, that you could subsume or you could place under this larger term of a worldview. And then you could use the different elements or categories within this larger thing of worldview as a basis for some kind of cross-cultural philosophical discussion that I was very interested in. I still am.
Definitely. Worldviews as a term gives us an opportunity to look from a larger perspective. And teachers definitely have a deep imprint on us. So probably your professor gave you the word worldview. So is dialogue possible?
He did.
Wonderful, wonderful. I was wondering, it's very important to ask, is dialogue possible between Hindu theological traditions and contemporary science?
You'd asked me to fill in a little bit of my background. So, you know, this was a question that I was asked many years ago. And it was kind of posed to me again, starting in Santa Barbara. I took a class on science and religion. It was an undergraduate level class when I was getting my bachelor's degree. And the class was actually taught by a professor of Buddhism. And he was interested in William James and Ned Block, different contemporary philosophers of mind and things like that. But he was really interested in looking at the way that Buddhism could potentially engage with the sciences. And I was more interested in Hindu philosophies and histories and things of that nature. So that's when I started to ask the question myself. And I think I'm still asking the question to this day. And I'm not quite sure I have an answer yet. But over the years, as I've engaged with that very question, I think it can be brought into a kind of a bigger question of what exactly is a dialogue, what does it in fact mean to engage with any text or philosophy or idea, especially one that's older or more obscure, or outside of one's native tradition, especially, and that might be anything from an ancient Greek text like Plato or Aristotle to a medieval Hindu or Buddhist text, whatever. But for me, the bigger question now is, what happens when, living in the 21st century, we read something that's coming out of a different or older world and worldview and context? My tentative answer is, I think there are places that there is this potential for an understanding, between India and Europe. That's how I think about this now, as more of a intercontinental kind of, or something happening within this larger Eurasian civilization. But, you know, I think there are particular points, and I tried to highlight in the book that I wrote, particular areas where there are roadblocks, where there's really just two very different ways of looking at the world. And they may be just incommensurable. They may have really nothing much to say to each other at all. But then are there other areas where there's a similar interest, a similar concern, a similar enough view about the philosophy and the science that some kind of discussion can happen, where there's an understanding that takes place, and that this understanding is important. It's not a trivial understanding. It's something that informs us more about maybe even at the best, both traditions. You know, that's my kind of gold standard for answering this question of whether or not dialogue is possible, is the kind of thing that I'm looking for at this point is as follows. Does this discussion that we're having, if we're looking at an Indian and a European text and philosophy, and we're talking about them together, do we understand both of them better through dialogue or not? It's one thing to say we're going to engage in a comparative exercise where we're going to comparative religion, comparative philosophy, whatever, comparative science, whatever it might be, and to say that we're going to understand India very well through this, and we're going to understand some aspect of Europe very well. That's a nice result. But maybe a better result is that you walk away from this where you thinking, I understand India in a better, in a way that I could not have understood India had I not understood something from the West or from Europe. And now I understand Europe in a way that I could not have understood had I not engaged with Indian thought. And, you know, I'm not totally settled on whether a dialogue in these senses is possible. But I think so. And I think it's something that is very important to students and to scholars and the public. And so it should be attempted.
Thank you for answering that, John. I believe dialogue as a means of understanding each other is definitely food for thought for the audience. So can you speak a little bit about Darwinianism and reception of evolution by natural selection?
Yeah, sure. So the topics that I take up in the book are really informed by my next degree that I took, which was at Oxford University when I was a student in Santa Barbara. The John Templeton Foundation had funded a series of lectures, and there were many, many lectures on science and religion while I was an undergraduate student. There was a great time to be there because of it. All kinds of topics: science, philosophy, theology, history, art, all kinds of different topics. But one of the people that really struck me, and I was John Hedley Brook, and he gave a talk on Darwinism and its reception in especially England and the United States, English-speaking countries. So I wanted to study more of that. And he was teaching, and he told me when he came, he said, I teach a master's program in science and religion. And I applied and I got in. And I went and I took the degree. And it was a great time to be there in Oxford as well, because there was so much interest in science and religion at the time. And I believe it still is the case. And so one of the things I learned a lot about was the complexity of reception. How complex was the reception of a view like Darwin? Darwin's theory of natural selection, where there are many different types of responses from all different types of people, and that we should not reduce the history of the reception of Darwinism to a single narrative. It wasn't that Darwin was immediately rejected, nor is it the case that he was immediately accepted. It's not that people saw his views as a threat to religion, and it's not the case that everybody saw it as amenable to religion. Rather, in fact, what I learned and what I continue to teach and to see is that there were many, many different types of responses to Darwin. Some that immediately leapt on this as, you know, this is a great new idea for philosophy, for religion, for linguistics, for history, for everything. And there were some that were very, very opposed to it. And there were some that were opposed to certain parts of it and accepted other parts of it. And it really was a time, and I think Darwinism continues to be a kind of catalyst for dialogue, for discussion of philosophy, of scientific issues, religious issues, all types of things. So that was what I learned there. What I wanted to study then, what I began to touch upon in my book, and is I became interested in how Indians, especially Hindu Indians, responded to Darwinism. And again, what I found is it was a very, Darwinism had a big impact, and it was, a very complicated situation where there were many different types of responses to his thought, and people reacted to it in very different ways than your English-speaking people did. But there were certain patterns that were the same, and one of those patterns was it wasn't easy to say, oh, all Hindus accepted evolution, or all Hindus rejected evolution, or anything in between. What you find is that you start reading the philosophies, especially of some of the noteworthy thinkers and authors of the time, they had all different types of views. And I continue to see that to this day as I teach about these topics and talk with colleagues. People have all kinds of different ideas about it.
I'm sure. A lot of views exist on Darwinism. As a Hindu, I would say that it is a talk we have every day, that humans evolved from monkeys. So this exists along with the theological opinion which comes out of the Hindu text and all of that. So I was wondering, what are the different views of mind and consciousness in Bhagavad Puran and Darwinism? And what are the frequently overlooked similarities? And how can these views be reconciled?
Okay, so there's a lot of questions there. So for the first, what is the Bhagavata's view? This is something that I, after I wrote that book, that I really began to be interested in. What is the text say itself, and then the commentarial traditions. And I've focused on a fellow named Sridhar Swami, who wrote probably the early 15th century, late 14th century. I think he's probably a Rissan. I think he most likely was involved with the Shankara Mutt in Govardhana and Jagannath Puri. He wrote a very well-known commentary on the Bhagavata Purana. Became interested in Jiva Goswami, who had read Sridhara and had wrote about him. And I became interested in all kinds of different views that they were connected with, especially those of Shankara and Vachaspati Mishra and all the non-duality line of thinking of Indian Hindu philosophy and theology. And I became interested in, to a certain degree, Nyaya, because I think especially Jiva was influenced by Navya Nyaya, a prominent school of Indian logic, and it was studied and taught where Chaitanya lived in the 15th century, 16th early and early 16th century, and then of course there's the Samkhya Yoga, as well. And that has also a very long and distinguished history. So I think in terms of the actual text of the Bhagavata, it uses the language frequently of Sankhya and Yoga. And those familiar with that language and worldview, if you will, know that it's a kind of a dualistic system. There's a material substance and the called Prakriti, and Prakriti is a little bit different than, and this is the kind of the goal of the second chapter of the book that we're talking about today, is to show that there's something unique there in the sense that to the West, it's unique to the West, I believe. I'd be happy to be shown wrong on this, but Prakriti has a kind of mind element built into it, a sort of subtle mental and intellectual and then the ahankara, which you could call the ego, kind of built into it. And then the Sankhya Yoga tradition says that there's something separate and different from that, that they call the Purusha, the Atman, or the, you can refer to it as the Jiva also, or the, you know, the seer, the drashtar, maybe even the agent, the karta, so all these different things. And but that's fundamentally different than in the Bhagavata than this material substance. That seems to be the and then, you know, the dominant view of the Bhagavata, although it seems to also be aware of Vaisheshika and Nyaya philosophy to a certain degree, seems to be very aware of Vedanta, especially non-dualistic schools of Vedanta. And it's a bhakti text as well. It's heavily influenced by South Indian bhakti traditions and I think probably Shaiva bhakti traditions from North and Central India, the emerging North Indian bhakti traditions. It's influenced by all of that. So unlike the traditional classical Sankhya yoga, say of Ishvara Krishna or the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali and all the commentaries on that, the Bhagavata Sankhya yoga affirms some kind of Purusha or self that's more than just a witness, as you get in Sankhya yoga. In Sankhya yoga, the self is really just a witness. It doesn't really interact directly with materiality. It just watches materiality. And once it's separated from materiality, the self of the Sankhya yoga really is, there's not much left. It's just a pure witness, but not a witness of anything. So it's a seer with no seen object, no sensation. And that's all that the Sankhya yoga tradition wanted to say about the self, the Atma, the Purusha in its tradition. Whereas the Bhagavata Sankhya yoga, perhaps as much as a millennium later in the classical Sankhya yoga, affirms a Purusha, which is very active. It has a lot of, it's a soul that has a kind of being and personality. And so it takes the basic ontological or metaphysical framework of Sankhya yoga, but adds to it a kind of a devotional concept and a very personal, to use a term of a colleague of mine, Jan Olof Bengtsson, it's a personalism. The self ends up being having a body and engaging directly with God and as typical to the bhakti traditions. So that maybe addresses your question about the Bhagavata's view. And then, of course, as I said, I've been interested more recently in how the views of the Bhagavata have been developed in the commentaries. But I think you'd had also asked about the Darwinian views of consciousness.
And what are the frequently overlooked similarities? Yeah.
Okay, so Darwinism is maybe a bit of a more difficult thing to capture because, you know, Darwinism as a philosophy or as a science is not really talking about what we would call consciousness so much, but about Darwin and Darwinists and interested in the biological processes and biological form and structure, whether it's the, you know, the way plants and animals organize colonies, or the way that bacteria work, or whatever. And I think it's Darwinism itself. Darwin himself really had not much to say about the soul. He was okay with the idea that that life had emerged naturally, some kind of natural process, and that it evolves and develops over time. This in the West seems to contradict or problematize at least the notion that the self is made in the image of God, the Imago Dei doctrine, which is a rational view that the self, the soul is rational. Like God, soul is rational. We are rational creatures, whereas animals are not necessarily. That had been the classical Greek view, and then the sort of traditional Christian, and I think to a large extent the Jewish and Islamic view as well. I'm not entirely sure. Darwinism and Darwinist may adopt some sort of reconciliation between classical Western philosophical and religious views in some cases, and some may adopt a more, I've called physicalism or a naturalistic or a materialistic view of consciousness that basically, as I describe, I think also in the second chapter of the book, basically that whatever the nature of life is, it's fully dependent on the body and the functioning brain, and it has to have that to exist. And if once the brain and the body stop working, then there's that thing that we call life ends permanently. It doesn't ever come back. Now maybe some want to say that you can take the information that is the self, this, and maybe transfer it to another substrate, some kind of computer, for example. But they will also nevertheless agree that whatever we call this thing life, it is fully dependent on materiality in some way. So there are really two different views. The Hindu view, and this is really contradictory to all Indian religious views, Jain and Buddhist. I don't know about Zoroastrian, but Sikh as well. And I would say this is true of Indian Islam and Christianity, but all the native Indian views say that whatever this self is, the consciousness, the Atman, it can exist independent of the physical body. That's how it can reincarnate. It has to be able to separate in some way from the body. Most, I would say, it's maybe I exaggerate too much, but I'd say at least it's fair to say many contemporary Darwinists and philosophers and people who look at these topics would probably lean much more towards some form of materialism. Others might espouse some kind of reconciliation between a Christian or a Jewish or an Islamic, what have you, some kind of view that the soul is rational and some kind of relates with the body in some way that doesn't contradict Darwinism. People have worked these things out in various ways. So again, the answer is it's a fairly complicated situation when you talk about how Darwinists and theologians and philosophers and whatever have reacted to Darwin. It's a little bit complicated. Now, the area of overlap, this is a difficult question. Because from what I'd said before, I think to have a kind of comparative discussion that's fruitful, there has to be some common ground. You need to share some kind of understanding with one another, to agree on something. Mm-hmm. And if you've got this Indian view that says that whatever consciousness is, it can exist independently of a physical body and a brain, And if you've got a Darwinian view that says it can't, it's really kind of a conversation stopper. There's not much more you can say at that point other than, yeah, okay, two different views have nothing to do with one another. The way that I have approached this issue then, and the way that I look at it now is as follows. The more I, and maybe this was influenced by my reading of Western philosophical ideas that really advocate a kind of physicalism or materialism, but the more I look at the Hindu views, I'm led to think that what they are actually saying is that whatever this thing called the self is, it upon identifying, they call it the ahankara, upon appropriating, I like the word appropriating as well, upon appropriating a particular physical body, that this thing called the self really takes on all of the characteristics and properties of that body through this thing called the ahankara, the ego. And that once that physical body dies and this self goes on to identify or appropriate a new body, as is the doctrine of reincarnation in all of the ancient native Indian religions, it then begins the whole process anew. And it reappropriates a new body. And all the stuff that happened with the old body is gone to a large degree. The memories, they just die with the brain and the body, the connections. And to me, the question is, what do the Indian philosophies say is transferred over? And when the self goes into a new body, and I don't know if that creates a potential for any kind of constructive philosophical engagement between the two, but the best answer that I have at this point is that what the Indian traditions are saying is that you don't need to disbelieve the idea that the relationship between thought, consciousness, and body or brain is very, very tightly wound. And that's really the argument that I think I make in chapter 2 of the book, is that it appears to me, at least in the Hindu texts that I was studying and have continued to study, that, you know, this idea that what we call ourself right now in this state of the ahankara, of the ego, or what they also call ignorance, the state of avidya, whatever we call ourselves now is very much defined by the body. And because the body produces thoughts and it contains memories and intellect and, you know, powers of cognition, decision making, all of the things that people in, say, neuroscience, philosophy of mind, Darwinistic views about biology and self, all of these people are interested in those topics, as am I. You know, how does the brain create our experience of the world? I don't think the argument that I end up making in chapter 2 is that, despite the fact that Indian texts, this Hindu text especially, are affirming some kind of reincarnation model where this consciousness can separate from and move on to another body, nevertheless, in terms of what we might call embodied consciousness, or just living, just being in a body, having a body, the human experience is very much defined by the physical body and the brain and all the aspects of it. And so the argument would be that I've made is that for the people interested in Indian philosophy, that this dialogue is possible because of this common concern of really understanding very scientifically this relationship between consciousness, I mean, I call it embodied consciousness, but consciousness and the physical substrate, the brain, especially. That's my answer thus far.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, thank you so much for answering this question in such an expansive manner, John. I hope that's so helpful for all the audience that's here with us today. Moving on, in what ways have the Hindu theologians articulated relationships between the instruments of knowledge, especially with reference to testimony and personal experience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's another major roadblock that I see potentially between religion and science, this discussion between religion and science, but also in particular with regard to with Hinduism, because Hinduism affirms, for many, have affirmed this idea that there is what they call Shabda Pramana, what you might call a linguistic authority, the authority of the word. And this, the authority of the word on all matters. Now, the real question is, does the authority of the word cover topics like science that are engageable through what the Hindu texts call sense perception and reason, or pratyaksha and anumana? Very complicated answers. Again, there's just so many different ways that people answer these questions, and it's continues to be a debate, and it certainly was in the time of the composition of the Bhagavata Purana and all the commentaries after it. Many different types of answers. The tradition I was working in particular takes a very tradition, what we might call conservative traditional religious view, that the text, that this Hindu text, especially the Bhagavata Purana, it is an authority. The language of the text can trump, if you will, other types of authorities, especially sense perception and reason. And that raises problems, because that's not how science functions in any way. That's not even really how philosophy or a large degree theology is conducted in the contemporary world. So that was something that I wanted to look at in the book as well. But yeah, the answer to your direct answer to your question, what is the how do different Hindu thinkers, theologians respond? The answer is many, many different sorts of ways, and it continues to amaze me how much attention was given to this topic in the history of India.
Thank you, John. So moving to the last question, in chapter 5, you talk about some closer comparisons, parallels of objectivity and testimony to implicate how we can view science and religion as sharing some important epistemological values. Can you elaborate a bit on it?
Sure. Yeah. So this is this was the probably my favorite part of doing the whole book. And just to bring it back to my, you'd asked me to talk about my education, and just to bring it back to my education, when I was in England, I studied in England, there were, I was part of a center called the Ian Ramsey Center. I participated in the Ian Ramsey Center for the Study of Science and Religion. And my college was Harris Manchester College, and the person I was working with, John Headley Brook, really directed me towards a lot of people from many different faith traditions, Christian, Jewish, mainly Christian, Jewish, and Islamic, I would say kind of in that order as well, mainly Christian, some Jewish, and a few Islamic thinkers, who were also some of the world's leading scientists. That's what I found. They may have been, you know, a professor of biology at Cambridge or Harvard or a leading school in California or Texas or whatever. But, you know, they were also interested in their religious tradition in some way. And that kind of opened me up to a world I hadn't really seen before, which was a world of functioning scientists, I would call. A lot of times at where I was, really kind of top of the line, the most high functioning scientists of all different types, not even biologists, physicists, anthropologists, linguists, people interested in all kinds of topics. And so I saw that there was this common interest among these people in both their religion and their science. And what I wanted to do in the Hindu text is to see exactly where was this overlap. And that was really the culminating chapter there, that I saw that what I called teleology, that the Hindu traditions that I was studying did see the way that I saw with the Western thinkers that I was interacting with, did see the development of their religious faith and tradition as augmented or supported by a deep understanding of nature as well, a kind of scientific understanding. So I call this a kind of common teleology, common interest in the sense that the traditions, there were certain people within them and certain texts and histories within these different traditions that they, whether they disagreed about this, that, or the other view, there was this common belief that we can resolve, that these questions about science and religion and nature and supernature, whatever's beyond nature, these are all important questions that we should investigate using human reason and the best scientific tools of our time. And I saw that common interest there. And I think that the conclusion of the book is really that what I wanted to end with was that what I saw in the Hindu traditions I was working with was this other important sensibility, which is a willingness to be wrong and to revise. That's kind of what I see as the great mystery of science and the great power of science, is it's willing to discard beliefs that have been proven false. And there's a process that is thought about and refined for falsifying and for evaluating and improving human knowledge. And the more I looked at Hindu texts, I saw that this is both a problem for some Hindu thinkers and also not a problem, that there are cases in history of Hinduism, in the history of Hinduism, where people were willing to revise and discard old beliefs in light of new knowledge, and that there were even within the Hindu traditions, linguistic theories about, I guess we could call them epistemologies or views about knowledge in the text that seem to support this, that gave a kind of justification for discarding ideas that don't make sense, that in light of new knowledge or in light of a new understanding of things. So that's where I left the book, is that you can dig out of both traditions two things, a common interest in the study of science and nature together, and also a common interest in taking the result of that study very seriously, and if need be, discarding beliefs that just no longer make sense in light of new evidence.
Thank you, John. I believe all we need for curating a dialogue is a common interest, and you did find that in the book. So, well, thank you so much for answering these questions, which are only a few among the, there are many other questions that our audience would like to know probably later. So, John, we've taken up a lot of your time, but I must ask you, what are you working on now?
Sure, thank you. Mainly for the past few years, I've been interested in commentaries, learning the Sanskrit language and learning how commentaries functioned, how they approached texts, and what they said. So I've been doing some work on Jiva Goswami, reading a lot of his work, and looking at just different topics. I guess you would call it the Gaudiya Vaishnava or the Chaitanya Vaishnava tradition, which, as I'd kind of alluded to in the beginning, very learned people who were aware of a lot of different ancient traditions and medieval traditions of things in aesthetics and epistemology and logic and narratives and all kinds of different issues. So I've been interested in, I've been writing about their views on different topics. And more recently, I'm interested in returning to this kind of comparative approach, this time more directly engaging with the history of Christian and Greek philosophy and theology. And so people like Aquinas and Aristotle and all of the people that they were interested in. And of course, once you do that, you have to contend with and engage contemporary understandings of both of them. They're mediated by the teachers that I'm working with now, people I'm studying now. But I'm writing a book right now in which I'm extending, kind of using a similar type of approach as in the first book, where I'm isolating certain topics, issues, ideas, especially philosophical topics, things related to knowledge and that now ethics and beauty and ontology, the nature of things. But I'm pulling out certain topics and finding those areas of common concern. It may not be the case that both traditions or both thinkers, I'm kind of working mainly with Jiva and Aquinas, but also the extended worlds around them. It may not be the case that they agree. It's probably not going to be the case that they totally agree. But I'm looking for those areas of common concern and interest, highlighting where they do agree, where they differ, but showing how they took a particular idea, a particular intellectual concern, and developed it. And hopefully, again, as with the first book, hopefully the fruit of that labor will be that we can have an enriched understanding of both sides that would not have been possible had we read them alone. Those are my kind of current projects.
Well, they sound like great projects, and I wish you luck for all your coming ventures.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for being on the show, John. I really enjoyed it. Also, thanking the audience for constantly supporting us. Keep reading, keep listening, keep enjoying. Bye. Take care.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.